This episode of the Braving Business Podcast is sponsored by, well, me. I'm PJ Benoit, and I've been in the domestic and international logistics space for over 30 years. If you need any assistance with transportation or logistics, my team and I will jump at the chance to help. Whether it be parcel shipments, e-commerce, pallets and freight, full truckload, international air and ocean, imports, exports, warehousing and distribution, or really anything under the logistics umbrella, we got you covered. For more details, please go to shipwithpj.com. That's shipwithpj.com. Reach out to me there. Mention you found me on this podcast for a special surprise. And one last quick thing. If you enjoyed this episode, please stay on after the show to learn more about the Braving Business Podcast and other great episodes for you to discover. And now, let's get the show started. Well, hello there.
Hello there, sir.
Hello there, sir. How are you, buddy?
I'm awesome. I get to see you twice in the same week.
I know.
That doesn't happen very often.
I know. Consider both your eyes lucky. I wanted to, first of all, you look awesome. You look
thank
happy.
Thank you. Is that right? I am happy.
You are happy.
Thank you. Life is good.
That's good. You're also looking a little even more fit these days. I understand you've taken up the hobby of bicycling.
Yeah, cycling to those of us in the cycling world. Oh, yes, indeed.
Sorry.
I am now cycling an average of 75 miles a week.
Jeez. My God. I don't even drive that many miles a week. So
I actually don't think I drive that many miles either, but I am biking that many miles. So Joe, do you cycle at all? Are you a cyclist?
No, I don't do any cycling. I used to do swimming and running, but I never got to the cycling. So I was
okay. Well, so you are nearly a triathlete, but not.
That's well, what I mean. Nearly.
Well, yeah. All right. Don't let him see. So I know a little bit about Joe as well, and Joe has done some physical feats like ultra marathons and stuff that.
No way.
Yeah. He's all about it. Okay. So don't let him be humble.
All right.
Don't let him.
I can't tell. He's sitting down. He looks husky.
No. The we're talking about my history, not my current situation.
All right.
But look, I am thrilled to introduce this man. So I'm going to just jump into it. If that's all right with you guys.
It's absolutely perfect, PJ. Right. Why don't you do that?
So I have two brothers from different mothers on the show today, of course, Tal, and my good buddy, Joe Huss. Joe is an experienced entrepreneur and global business leader of over 25 years in product development, manufacturing, and supply chain management. Raised in an entrepreneurial family, Joe learned early about the highs and lows of business, a background that fueled his own personal drive to succeed. His journey took him across the world, starting from Canada to Asia, where he founded his own sourcing and supply chain company. Today, as the founder of Supply Chain Best, Joe brings a deep end-to-end understanding of product strategy, helping businesses grow by connecting them with tailored, collaborative solutions. Throughout his career, Joe has faced numerous challenges, from starting his entrepreneurial journey in a foreign country with no safety net to enduring personal setbacks. And yet, he has always been guided by a commitment to personal growth and self-improvement, values that he continues to share as a mentor and a leader. Joe's passion for helping businesses succeed and building resilient partnerships is at the core of everything this young man does. Joe, thank you so very much for joining us on the Braving Business Podcast.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. It's quite an introduction.
It is. And you know, I was particularly struck by this young man, okay, we'll go with it.
I'll take it.
That's right. And you know what, that intro, while, you know, it gives you the credit you deserve for the career you've had, I think doesn't quite serve to tell the story that you've lived. And, you know, I feel privileged to have had the opportunity to learn some about you coming into this interview. And I'm looking forward to the audience getting to know you and your story, which begins in Egypt, actually, not in Canada. You end up being in Canada. Let's start with, you know, the first story you shared with us was around the fact that you were exposed to entrepreneurship very early in your life, and you saw members of your family, some of whom had entrepreneurial success and some of whom had entrepreneurial misery. How did these early experiences, and we're going to get to talking about you and your family. I usually start there. I'm going to give PJ a chance to ask the question that will really dig into your super interesting life story, including the fact that you nearly didn't live this life. But let's talk about this experience and this family that you grew up in with the highs and lows of business, as PJ mentioned. How did this shape your outlook on business and life, being in that setting?
So I think that's probably the most fundamental question of who I am in business, is because as a very young child growing up, you know, having been born in Egypt and growing up in Egypt, I watched my family start, launch, and grow very successful businesses and having them just taken away by the government, which there are plenty of entrepreneurial, you know, misery stories in Egypt. We're not unique in that. And I think that really framed it for me, that nothing is permanent and you've got to really work for it. And if you lose it, well, you got to do it again.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, share, if you wouldn't mind, share as much as you want about that story though, right? About your parents, your dad in particular, having that company, what he did, and then what happened literally overnight.
Yeah, I mean, the story exists for multiple different family members, but for my father, he used to import essential oils and products into Egypt. At the time, it was a hub for manufacturing, and then he would export finished, you know, soaps, shampoos, products like that back to Europe. And just one day he showed up at the office, you know, the door was boarded, there was an armed guard, and now it was a government company. So he had to decide, you know, what his future was going to be, whether he was going to work for the government, if you will, or have to start over somewhere else, you know. And we decided, obviously, not we, I wasn't part of that decision, but he decided to start over. And obviously it's not our home. So, you know, we got out of there.
Interesting. So was this before or after your heart surgery? Because as an 18-month-old, you had heart surgery.
Yeah, so this was after the heart surgery. We had that heart surgery when I was 18 months old in Philadelphia, and that whole process was extremely complicated because there's obviously no, you know, insurance or anything like that. So my father had to pull together a lot of resources with my mother and, you know, liquidate assets and so forth to pay for the trip and the surgery. And then once we came back, you know, he spent a number of years really breaking his back to rebuild, and then the business got shut down. So,
jeez.
Or I should say taken over, not shut down.
So how did this experience, knowing that your parents gave up everything for you, and then everything that they rebuild gets taken away, how did that influence your sense of responsibility and work ethic for you?
I mean, it's, as you can imagine, it's incredibly humbling to be in a position where you start your life understanding that people are willing to give up everything to give you a better chance. And, you know, my brother and I, we really, in a sense, we started over. By the time we got to Canada, we started in, you know, we went through Europe and then we went to Boston, then we ended up in Canada. And for us, it was always about, well, we just got to work and we got to support the family too. And it's, you know, we're all in this together. They're willing to give it up to give us a chance. The least we can do is, you know, do our best to have a major impact on the family and carry that forward to the next generation. And obviously, you know, our kids and our parents.
So this work ethic, as you described it, when you were a young teen, and I think you said you were 15, or you think you were 15, you were working at Pizza Hut, and you were pretty committed to self-improvement. And I'd love to know what was the motivation for you even caring about self-improvement. But you shared with us that an older colleague saw that you were interested in this topic. He gave you the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, which you devoured in a single day. You went on to read other very interesting books. Well, we could talk about that in a second, but I'd love to start with where did this original interest in self-improvement come from at that age, right? For a lot of us, for me, the pursuit of self-improvement didn't begin into, heck, probably my 40s. How did you even think to be looking at self-improvement books at the age of 15? Where did that even come from?
I mean, I wish I had a great reasoning behind it. I think it's more around the fact that I just felt like I could do better. you know, and I, things were difficult and I had to work really, really hard. And, the harder I worked, the more I wanted to be better at what I did. So I was searching for ways to do that. And, you know, How to Win Friends and Influence People really helped because it allowed me to, understand and frame the way in which I interacted with other people, which was critically important, in my, path to evolving as a person. And then from there, I just, it became a voracious thing for me. I just wanted to take more and more and more and learn and get better. And I realized that, you know, because I wasn't naturally amazing at anything, I needed to get more in my tool belt. And I felt like learning from, you know, these people who have done amazing things or learned amazing things could help me.
Very cool. Very cool. I've never really done much self-improvement because I'm kind of perfect. So that's, I'm glad you found that book and it really helped you.
I actually thought you wrote that book, PJ, but that's okay.
No, I wrote the, Hey, I'm Perfect book. I didn't write the How to Win Friends and all that stuff. Gotcha. So Joe, you have lived everywhere. You've lived and worked in very diverse places around the world. I know that you spent, what was it? 6 years? Was it 6 years in Asia?
I lived, 6 years in Asia.
Okay. So during that time in Asia, was there like,
PJ, do you mind, before we go into Asia, I'm deeply curious what lessons you took from How to Win Friends and Influence People that maybe our listeners can use. I'm sorry to disrupt you moving forward, but I don't want to move forward yet. Joe's got an interesting life, and I happen to think that book is one of the most profound books ever written, and it's a shame that a lot of people nowadays don't know the profound lessons that they could pick up from that book, which is another book I didn't pick up until many, many years into my career. What are one or two things, lessons you potentially could share with our audience from that book that listeners can use right now?
So that's great. I mean, I honestly think that the most profound thing that stuck with me on that was I was approaching my life very much from, you know, what I wanted out of it and how I could achieve those things and how I could do things. And I think How to Win Friends and Influence People really made me look at myself and realize that the only way that I can advance is by getting people to want me to succeed. And the only way to do that is to get people is to think about them and focus on what is really important to other people. And if I can get them what they want, then indirectly, I'm also going to achieve what I want, but I have to think about other people first.
So what a great takeaway. It's interesting that that's, I would say, probably my number one takeaway as well. And I actually wrote a blog post some months back about a skill that I think most entrepreneurs could, particularly starting their careers, should devote a lot of time to, and that's follow through. And a lot of follow through is about listening and understanding what it is that motivates people, what it is that they're looking for. I find that the most common thing people are looking for is to have confidence that you're listening to them and that you are trying to understand their needs. And that when you do, you will be meticulous about follow through and keeping them posted. How do you convey to people? And I'm PJ, I'm sort of running, you know, roughshod here. So sorry for stepping in on a question that you started asking, and I'll let you get right back to that.
No worries.
But how do you share with people that you are aligned with making sure that their interests are covered? What is a way that you can convey that?
So, you know, that's a really tough question for me because I don't, to me, that's not a tactical action. To me, I just have to be genuine. And if I'm really genuine and I truly believe that I'm doing something that is in someone's best interest, I guess it comes across, you know, and I don't really try to do that. I have to frame it that way for myself or else I won't be able to actually act on it. So I guess the answer to that is believe what you're doing and be genuine. Because if you're not genuine, I think that, you know, that speaks as loudly as, you know, you might as well not do it because it's going to actually show worse than if you were trying to do something and show disingenuous intentions.
Very cool. Very cool. You know, it's I have had the opportunity. So I know Joe personally And I can tell you that if we're relaying this back to Dale Carnegie's book, I know that Joe innately takes accountability for what he says to people. And I think, you know, in a roundabout way, how you get people to like you, how do you influence people? I think it kind of goes back to that old adage of your word is your bond, because I've seen Joe give his word to customers and to prospective partners of ours. And he takes it extremely personally, which is the way you should. And I think that, you know, in that application, when a lot of times these days people say a lot of stuff and there's a lot of fluff behind it, or there's, you know, not full intention behind what they're promising. But I know, and I've seen it in action and in work, that when Joe or someone who follows these creeds gives their word, they mean it and they take it to heart. And it's really seen as a full responsibility, which it should be. And I think that's how it comes across.
Well, I apologize. You've also seen the neurotic back end of that when I'm trying to live up to it.
I have. I've seen you be a little control freakish, but that's okay. You gotta do what you gotta do.
let me ask you this, Joe. Another lesson of that book that's really resonated for me, and I've been carrying, and I actually have the audience cannot see it, but it's on my wall. I have a little plaque where I've written the things winners avoid. I have the header, which I created myself mainly because I wanted the acronym for these words. Noteworthy CEOs are calm, resilient, inspiring, persistent, logical, agile, and passionate. But really, it's just because I wanted the N for noteworthy and the C for CEOs and the A for R. So the beginning of that is nagging, criticizing, arguing, complaining. And one of the things in the book that really, really resonated for me is not to criticize, not to condemn, not to complain. Is that a lesson that also resonated for you? And how do you live that?
Yeah, you're 100% right about that. I mean, I think I, you know, some people when I was younger used to call me MB for short, which was a miserable bastard. So I got that because I tended to be a little bit cynical about things because I wanted to get things done and I really wanted to you know, prove that I could do things. And I ended up overlooking the really important core view of that, which is, well, what am I actually achieving here and how am I impacting the people around me? And I think the way that I really remedied that was I decided to wake up every morning and make a conscious decision to look at the world differently. And I don't naturally have a sunny disposition. I mean, I'm a very happy person, but I believe that that takes work, you know, and I work at being happy with things. It's not generally a situational thing because, you know, I've been through very, very negative situations, and those situations, while you're in it, it sucks. But, you know, 5 minutes later, if you're not happy again, well, then you're reliving it again and again and again. And I needed to break away from that. So I kind of made that conscious decision to avoid wallowing in things.
Very cool. Very cool. All right. Now, can I ask about Asia?
I think you can. Yes. Thank you. I appreciate your indulgence.
It's totally okay. So, Joe, you've lived and worked in very diverse places. All right. So you're in Asia for about 6 years. Were there any moments during your time there, being in a completely foreign culture, that really tested your resilience as an entrepreneur?
So 100%. And it actually ties into the perfect segue that Tal just gave us, where you have to make that decision, right? Because you're going to be in these really difficult situations that sometimes feel like they're going to break you. You know, you're all alone. You have no support system. And this is anyone who's done anything outside of their comfort zone. I'm not saying I'm special in any way, or anyone in Asia or anywhere else in the world is special. It's just that when you get yourself really far out of your comfort zone, the thing that really sticks with you is, well, how do you now survive through this? And I guess, you know, I think I've told you this in the past, is I kind of see myself as a person that, you know, my superpower is I can take punishment over time. And I think you just end up looking at it and saying, well, I just will never quit. So it doesn't really matter what happens. It doesn't matter what you face. You've got it. You got to dig in. Now, sorry for the long path to that. But yes, there have been situations, for example, you know, when I'm in a situation in a factory, you know, where I have food poisoning and I have a flight to catch and, you know, I'm in some obscure little town in the outskirts of a country where nobody speaks anything close to the language I speak, you know, and, you know, and I'm trying to communicate to get something so that I'd stop, you know, throwing up and there's no way I can do that because I don't even know what's on the packaging. And, you know, I have a conference call in 2 hours and I look like I'm a homeless guy. And I, you know, there's been a lot of those situations. I mean, too many to count. And I think that's kind of just part of the struggle of being so far out of your comfort zone, but you've got to succeed anyway, and you have to push through. And in the end, what other choice do you have? You know, you can't throw your hands up. You're in it.
Remind me not to travel internationally.
You can actually, and a lot of people do. And I think that, you know, and you made this point in the pre-interview. I think it's a point that we've made on this podcast over and over again. What separates successful people from less successful people is not brilliance. It's not, you know, good looks. It's refusing to quit. It's recognizing the challenges are part of the journey and just fighting through, right? So in a foreign country, especially, right, starting in a business, you don't have a support system. That's hard enough. Okay. What were some challenges that you faced that really shaped the experience for you, and how did you overcome them? We know quitting wasn't one of the things that you chose to do. What did you face, and how did you overcome it?
So that's, you know, that question is really interesting, and I've pondered over it a lot. I know that, you know, for me, I didn't have a smooth transition. It's not like I went out there and I was, you know, a happy expat in Hong Kong, living in an expat environment, you know, having a good time. Like, I was kind of thrown right into the deep end, and I ended up in a lot of smaller places. And the biggest challenges I faced was where there was zero comfort. So I could not find any food that I was used to or comfortable with. I couldn't find anyone who spoke my language. Because I wasn't in a place where that was common. So it's that constant discomfort, where you never really get your feet on the ground and feel, okay, you know, I feel good. I feel comforted. So what I found was, Starbucks are the same anywhere in the world. And while the language around you is not, I used to just go to a Starbucks and I get myself a grande vanilla latte, and I would put my headphones on and I'd face the wall, like no joke, 2 feet from a wall. And I would either read a book, and it was BlackBerry in those days, so there wasn't much to look at on your phone other than email. So I would just get a book, do something, and just pretend I was anywhere in the world, you know? And sometimes all I needed was half an hour of that. Sometimes it was a couple hours, but, you know, just distancing myself from that constant discomfort was my way of dealing with it.
That's really fascinating. I think it speaks to something that I believe in as well, which is finding peace, finding your peace, right? And every one of us needs it and may pursue a different path to it, right? So I, as PJ knows, I speak about it often. I believe in meditation. Now that I cycle a lot, actually, I also use that time as a time of deep personal reflection, opportunity to think about where I feel my life is. I don't do it all the time. Sometimes I just listen to music. But if you feel acute distress, finding a way that works for you, whatever that is, to reset is really critical. And the earlier in your career you recognize that you need a reset, right? So if it's, and by the way, the earlier in your life, it's not even just a business thing, right? We need it in our personal lives as well. If you're able to recognize that you are reaching a point or a place where the way you're carrying yourself, your behavior is not representative of who you want to be, maybe not being the best version of yourself or whatever that is to you, no, developing a method, a way to get away from it and reset is one of the most valuable things that you could do. This would be true in your personal life. It's true in your professional life. I think that it sounds like you kind of naturally gravitated to a self-care method that worked for you. and you stuck with it. Does that sound right? I mean, does it sound like something that you can relate to? The need to
absolutely
find time. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. And you know, like what you're describing is how I evolved as a person. So I ended up, you know, I started at Starbucks, but being in Asia, there's plenty of tools to learn how to, you know, meditate and find yourself through I get a little more evolved ways than, you know, grande vanilla lattes, but so yes, you're right. I ended up, you know, taking time to learn how to do that in a more effective way, finding nature, finding places that were more comfortable for me to do that. And so you're right. That was something that, I started there. It was kind of my wall to push off. And then from there I developed, as I grew and matured, I developed better techniques to do that. And I found out that I got to deeper levels of, you know, self-care. That's a good way to put it, because in the end, you know, if you have to somehow balance your own life out. So if you're going through extreme things on one side, you also have to take a lot of care on the other side in order to make sure that you don't throw yourself off the deep end.
Well, I do have to say this is a little bit of a different interview, because I know Joe, and one of the reasons why I thought he was such a great candidate to be on the show is because he's one of the most fascinating people that I've met, in that there's discipline, but then there's also challenging yourself, and Joe always challenges himself. It's a very interesting thing, like physically, whether it's about learning something, or whether it's about you know, boy, I want to do better at this, or I want to grow at that. Joe goes all in, and he'll do it privately. Like, he doesn't do it for show. He just does it because he wants to better himself. And I think that's as someone objectively watching that, I think it's fascinating. It's also like, good on you, buddy. But it's really kind of cool. So I'm glad that you're sharing these viewpoints, Joe, because I find them very impressive.
I mean, PJ, that really means a lot to me. And I think, you know, it's funny because that really comes from a place that I don't think I'm that good. You know, I'm not that special. So I feel like I have to work harder and I've got to get better. And if I'm going to do that, I need to be genuine about it. And I need to really apply that for myself. And, you know, I'm not always good at it, and I'm not always good at learning. But, you know, that doesn't stop me from trying and earnestly making the effort.
Well, and that's the thing. Most people don't try, right? Most people don't try to learn different fasting techniques, or taking up Taekwondo, or like all these things that you've done, not Taekwondo, but Kenpo and all the other ones that you've done. It's like, it's just very fascinating to learn about all that, because you really do challenge yourself.
Are you a dangerous man, Joe? I mean, are you someone that could beat, like you could kill me with your bare hands kind of thing?
With his pinky.
With his pinky.
Oh, no. I choose to not comment on the grounds that I may incriminate myself.
Wow.
Very nice. Very nice. Thank God this is all remote. All right. So Joe, there was a period in your life where you kind of described it as being homeless twice. Can you share those stories and how they affected your perspective on success and failure?
So 100%. I mean, I don't want to, I mean, saying homeless, you know, a lot of people might be offended by me saying that, because I wasn't really technically homeless, right? It wasn't homeless and destitute. But there were times in my life where I had made decisions that left me in a place where it didn't make sense for me to have a home, I guess. So the first one is not, you know, basically I was traveling so much that it made no sense for me to have a home base. So I spent probably about 18 months literally living out of suitcase. And that, I mean, you know, cry me a river, big deal. It's not the end of the world, but it does do something to you in terms of your sense of belonging. So it makes you realize that you don't really belong to a place. You kind of belong to yourself, and you got to find ways to manage that and create environments around you wherever you are that allow you to sort of be solid and not have to have that comfort zone. So that's one thing that really made a difference. And without dragging this out too long, the other time was I made a business decision to go to a place, and I was in between marriages, if you will, getting divorced. And I ended up living with my business partner at the time for a period of time because I couldn't afford to get my own place. And I didn't want to take the next step without planning it properly and being on solid ground. So I decided to spend a few months in the living room.
So let's talk about partners, because that's a great segue. And you talked in the pre-interview about how important it is to surround yourself with the right people. And you talked about the experiences you had with your team in China and working with people from around the globe. Talk about the importance of surrounding yourself with the right people. First of all, what qualities do you look for in partners? And how does your pursuit of the right kind of people, do you think, contribute to the overall success you've had?
So I think I started out by just tolerating whatever came at me. And that led me to some pretty negative either relationships or situations. I'm talking professionally. And that was because I didn't know if on the other side of it, there was going to be another business opportunity, or I would be able to survive, or I'd be able to succeed. And I reached a certain point where I decided that the abuse was no longer worth it. So at that point, I said, I'm either going to just be by myself and figure this out, or I'm no longer going to accept to work with people that I don't admire and like. And to me, I would give a lot of credit, to my brother in this, is that he set a great example of the type of person that I really like being around. And, he's tolerant and he thinks a lot about other people and he cares about people and their success. And, so I kind of took that example and I thought, why would I want to work with anyone who doesn't hold those values and that care for other people? And to me, a lot of people can succeed. Success is not like, there is no one magic solution to success. But the important thing is how you approach that and how you impact the people around you while you do that. So I didn't want to be around people who were callous anymore and who didn't care about, the well-being of those that they worked with.
Sure. Sure. We're not going to dive too deep into it, because I know that there are some things that, you're just a private guy, but there are some things that you have been through, and you don't have to go into detail, but there are some things that you have been through where you had some coworkers, you had some,
but if you did, it might help people. So let's remember, part of the objective of this podcast and the reason we hold it is because we hope to influence people's lives to the better. And the experiences each of us have had, you, PJ, myself, and other guests, are an opportunity to help someone avoid something or help someone recognize something. So I'm certainly not going to ask you to talk about anything you're deadly uncomfortable talking about, but your candor about this topic, I think, could serve a lot of people well.
So my question is, when I know that you've had some bad people in the workplace that you've worked with, right? I think we all have, to be honest.
I think you're right. I think everybody has. That's accurate.
Yeah. Right. And some of them are really bad. I had a boss once that I remember he called me and he was like, I don't think you're working hard enough. I was a VP of the Midwest. And he's like, I don't think you're working hard enough. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm up until midnight answering things. I'm on the phone at 4 a.m. talking to Pakistan, getting shipments arranged. And he's like, no, you don't get what I mean. He said, I want you to never be home. I want you to, whenever you do get home, the food to be cold on the stove. I don't want your kids to know you. I want your wife to always be pissed at you. And I was like, okay, it's time for me to look for a new job. Right. But, but I'm also at that time, I'm the sole breadwinner. Right. So I have to put up with just some absolutely terrible, terrible human beings who somehow got into these positions. So my question is, what advice do you have for those who are not entrepreneurs, right? Or maybe they want to be an entrepreneur, but they are in a position where they are working with just some really bad actors. Like what advice would you give them?
I mean, that's a difficult question for me because, I mean, I'm not sure if my action there was the right action, right? So I was in a position where I felt my back was to the wall, and I have a severely handicapped daughter, and while I take very little credit for taking care of her mother and her new father had done that, but financially I had some serious obligations there, and I really felt early on especially that, you know, my back was really to the wall, where I, you know, if I went with what I wanted to do, which is I don't deserve this abuse and this is not good for me, then, you know, in the sense, the bigger picture I would have maybe failed in something that was more important to me. So I guess, you know, I don't think there is a one size fits all when it comes to this. And I think you have to do what's right for you. And, you know, like what was right for me in that scenario was taking some of that, that negative energy and living with it and finding ways to cope with it and becoming stronger and better as opposed to leaving it. So, you know, I don't think you're ever going to hear anyone else recommend that you stay in an abusive relationship. But, you know, for me in that moment, that was the right action. And I would say it has made me a much better person. You know, I think I don't really feel breakable emotionally or psychologically. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that I decided that none of these things were going to define me. And in the end, you know, big deal. Someone's going to be tough on me. Okay, well, I'll get stronger and I'll find a way through it. So, you know, I think work on mental toughness. I think that's really something that you probably don't hear a lot, but I think that's probably the one piece of advice that I would give if I had to.
What's interesting about that, we are talking about working for bad bosses, and I will, and PJ knows I've done this. I've occasionally called myself a recovering asshole. You know, as a young CEO, in businesses that, you know, I was starting, in some cases grew to substantial size, I allowed myself to offend. I allowed myself to not be considerate of people, or not consistently be considerate of people. So I alternated between being someone who really had people's backs because that was, you know, something I thought I valued, but my behavior didn't show it because I wasn't consistent about it. So what advice would you give to someone who's maybe in a position of leading and recognizes in themselves, which, because I did recognize it, it just took me a long time to develop a way to do it better. And I'm not perfect at it yet. So the people that work for me today would tell you that I still occasionally lapse, but I would say that by and large, I'm now consistently the version of myself I want to be. What advice would you give to someone who's maybe on the boss side and recognizes in themselves a streak of not necessarily being able to put the mental and emotional well-being of their workforce where it belongs, which is first?
So I actually can relate to that too. You know, when while I may have been very focused on improving myself and caring about other people, I also was very young and inexperienced and under a lot of pressure that I didn't handle very well. So I ended up being a bit of a, you know, a jerk as well as a leader. And I also was in an environment, you know, where that's a lot more tolerated. And, you know, when you're in Asia, the rules for conduct are a bit different. You know, they're not necessarily as watchful for appropriate employer conduct. And so I kind of felt like I was in that position too, Tal, and I had to sort of recover from that too. So the advice I would give is that you really have to reset what is the most important thing, you know, where you might hold a certain standard for yourself as, you know, something comes in and I need it answered within X period of time, because that's what I do. Therefore, that's what I expect of you to do. And it's unacceptable if you don't do that. You know, you're not living up to our expectations, therefore you're inferior in this organization. And, you know, that mindset, although you may not say it that way to a person, you may have that feeling inside you, and that creates that anxiety. And then you just feel angry because you want it to get done. You know, and I think somehow you got to let that steam out. And the tool that I used was just never talk to the person while I felt emotional. And then always try to, you know, rebalance myself and then reframe it to them in a way that I can actually help them improve and maybe get what I want out of it, but without making them feel bad. And that was a tough thing. And as you say, I mean, I still do that constantly. PJ can attest to the fact that, you know, that anxiety I have in myself to get things done a certain way, it sometimes spills out and I hate it, you know, and I think about it afterwards. I always try to go back and say, how could I have done that better or different? And I think if people see that you're trying to be better, sometimes they'll understand and give you a little bit of leeway and tolerance.
Well, and also, I will say this, knowing both of you guys in the workplace, if you ever think that you're truly assholes, you're really the small A asshole, because there are large capital A assholes out there that never have the self-reflection to know the damage that they're doing or the environment that they're creating, and they just don't care. And that's why they're capital A assholes, where you guys are like, you might have a bad day, or you might want to, you know, you might do something a little forcefully or poignantly where you're like, oh, okay, maybe I shouldn't have used that tone or said it too much, but you appreciate that. And then normally you go in and repair, which is an amazing thing, and very needed. But capital A assholes, they don't repair. And normally they fail eventually. So, and that's why we celebrate that.
Go ahead, Joe. Yeah. I'd love your perspective on what PJ just said.
No, I mean, that sounds a little weird, but I appreciate that because, you know, I think caring about it and trying to be better is all you can really aspire to. And you know, I'm happy to be the smaller A asshole in this case.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because my initial reaction when PJ started saying that was, well, you know what, I don't believe that I ever have a license to offend. And my personal goal is to get to a place where at my worst, I'm better than I am at my best now. So I want to get to a place of simply being so capable of keeping my emotions in check that I don't allow myself to offend under the worst of circumstances, which has not happened yet. I still occasionally offend. But then you went to a place that I really appreciate, PJ, which is you talked about self-awareness is about as much as we can ask of ourselves, right? We are human beings. We err because we're human. By being self-aware enough to want to repair and take action to repair, I guess we are as close to being the best version of ourselves as we can be.
Exactly.
Other than that, we would be gods, and we are not.
Correct.
So I appreciate that. I will proudly, add a t-shirt to our collection of t-shirts that you've never added to our website. Shame on you.
Which I will.
Would be a shirt that says asshole with a lowercase a in parentheses. That would be really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Happy.
All right. Well, thank you. That's exciting. Those shirts are coming.
They are. So last question, with all of your extensive experience, what advice would you give to young aspiring entrepreneurs who may be struggling with self-doubt or struggling with finding their way in business? What good brass rings are you going to put out there for those people to grab onto?
So I think those are two separate questions. I think if you're struggling to find your way in business, stop, find your way, and then continue, because you're going to go down a bad path if you're. So I mean, that would be my first statement. If that's, you know, for that, for someone who's struggling with self-doubt, I think that self-doubt is an incredible strength. And I think you need to look at self-doubt as something that can drive you and differentiate you from other people, because the people who are going to run directly into a wall are the people that have no doubt. So self-doubt makes you question, makes you better, makes you want to learn, makes you want to understand how other people are doing things that may benefit, you know, you and, you know, society as a whole. So I honestly believe if you have self-doubt, that's fantastic. It means you're a good person, means you care about improving and you want to do good. So, you know, I would say if you have self-doubt, read more, learn more, talk to successful people, get out there, get a mentor, figure out a way, because that just means that you're on the path of being better and doing something special, because most people in that scenario would just quit.
Joe, I wonder how you'd feel about this. I love what you just answered. Yeah. I think self-doubt is a strength if it's harnessed, right? If you allow it to debilitate you, if you allow it to paralyze you, then that's a problem. But if you use it to recognize that, hey, I doubt because I want to do better, I want to be better, I want to be the best version of myself, then that's a positive self-doubt. How do you feel about this is something that I have come into contact with relatively recently, and I find it very valuable, so I'm going to share it, and I'd love your opinion about it. That in our heads, the voice that we hear is not so-called us, it's really a narrator. Our lives are being narrated, and the narrators are people that have been in our lives and have influenced us. So we have a narrator who may be a negative Nancy, could be a parent, could be a friend, could be a partner, could be a boss, somebody who beat us down, and their narration is a narration that we turn to from time to time in moments of doubt. And there is also a narrator in our heads that's an ally, someone that has seen us at our best and has encouraged us through difficult times and has seen us rise to the occasion. Self-doubt is oftentimes a product of the experiences we've had and the people that have spoken to us. How do you, first of all, does that resonate for you? And second, if it does, how would you advise people to be able to separate, you know, self-doubt that's about seeking to improve from self-doubt that's based on suffering trauma and having people that traumatized you enough that they're still in your head?
I mean, that is pretty profound. Honestly, like, I think you really nailed it. I think that talk that we hear in our head is not us. And, you know, that's our psychology. And that's the buffer, if you will, between us and the world around us and society. And that's what's constantly just bombarding us with information that's very confusing. And for me, what really helped was meditation. And I was able in meditation to quiet all of that. And when you quiet all of that, your true self is there, but your true self isn't very talkative, right? Your true self, it basically, you know, can make you feel something like, I will never quit. Your true self can make you feel something like, I can find a way. Your true self, you know, is not a negative voice. And if you're able to silence all that other noise, which is, in my opinion, psychology, and you don't have to do it through meditation. If you have other ways of doing it, that's great. But I think the answer there is just finding that true voice that just gives you a single directive, because all the other noise is very confusing.
Love you know, that. There's a book that I would highly recommend to people, which is called The Mastery of Self by Don Miguel Ruiz Jr. His father, Don Miguel Ruiz, is very famous. He wrote The Four Agreements and some other great books. But The Mastery of Self is a book that I came into contact with fairly recently and was profound. You know, it really talked about these very things we've just touched on. And I think it's wonderful that, you know, you're in the place that you are. And I think that you recognized fairly early on in your life the value of self-improvement. And hopefully the people that listen to this podcast, wherever they are in their careers, whether this is, you know, whether they're college students, like some of the kids at the University of South Florida, at the business school, including the one I mentor and others listen to, because they are trying to get, you know, trying to gain some wisdom from the guests who come on and are willing to be vulnerable, like you've been willing to be, or people later on in their careers who are just trying to find a better path. I think being able to recognize what's setting us back at any age is invaluable. And then developing a method, a way, a path to help yourself find yourself. It sounds weird, right? What do you mean find myself? I'm with myself all the time. Not so much. I think it turns out that a lot of us spend a whole lot of our time in our bodies, but not in our, not really in our souls. And I think being able to do that is as valuable a thing as anyone can do, professionally and personally.
I strongly agree with that, you know, and I was just reminded of a moment when you said that, and I don't know if we have a couple of seconds for me to share this, but I was in Xiamen in China, somewhere maybe 3-4 years into my time in Asia. And I was, you know, in the middle of two big customer projects, you know, financially, it wasn't a great time. And I was in a hotel that wasn't very good. And I went outside and I was sitting on this little tiny patch of grass with like insanity happening around me. This big bus pulled up and it was spewing exhaust in my face. And I'm just sitting there. And in that moment, I found absolute peace and I started laughing because I realized that nothing around me mattered, you know, and everything was within me and was the strength and everything came from that. And I kind of just said to myself, well, you know, whatever happens from here, you know, that was a perfect moment. And it wasn't because the environment was perfect. It was just because I found peace in that moment. And I think that kind of ties into what you're saying is you kind of have to just find that peace within yourself, regardless of your circumstances.
What great advice. Our guest today, Joe Haas, we didn't get to talk a whole lot about Supply Chain Best, and not very much at all, in fact, but he's the founder of Supply Chain Best, a company that's done very well. And he's shared a tremendous amount of knowledge and insights with all of you today. Joe, I really appreciate your time. I'd love to have you back on the show down the road. Continued success with your company and in your life. And thank you for choosing to be vulnerable with our audience today.
That was amazing.
Thanks. Thanks so much, Tal. Thanks, BJ. Appreciate it, guys.
You're the best, man. And that's a wrap, folks. Like what you heard, want to support the show? Please follow our page on LinkedIn and Facebook. Visit us on YouTube. And please like and rate us on all of your favorite podcast streaming services. You can also see exclusive content, subscribe for free to our weekly blog, support our sponsors, and soon buy our merchandise at www.bravingbusiness.com. Thanks for being a part of our production, and we'll see you next time on the Braving Business Podcast.